started. I'm Lisa Donner, and I'm the Executive Director of Americans for Financial Reform, which is a coalition of more than 250 organizations working together towards the goal of a financial system that better serves the real economy and puts it at less risk. Thank you very much for joining us on this call today, both to the speakers and to the listeners. A moment of logistics before we start. If I could ask everyone to put themselves on mute while they're not talking, we would very much appreciate it. And then unmute yourselves when you have questions. Again, if folks can put themselves on mute while they're not talking, we would all appreciate it very much. We are recording this call, and we'll have the recording available on our website afterwards. So we're doing this because there's been a great deal of public hand-wringing in recent weeks about the terrible burden that the extraterritorial research derivatives regulation is going to put on a large financial institution. And we are fearful that this hand-wringing is actually more or less a last-ditch campaign to undermine effective derivatives regulation in any context, because as Dodd-Frank recognizes, you can't effectively regulate this market if you don't have international reach, and that's what we want to talk about in a great deal more detail today. I'm going to introduce our four presenters, ask each of them to speak for a couple moments, and then we will open the call up to questions. Forgive me for repeating myself one more time, asking people to put themselves on mute while they're not talking. Our first speaker is Michael Greenberger. Professor Michael Greenberger is the founder and director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland and a professor at the School of Law there. After many years in private practice, he became in 1997 the director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the CFTC, where he served under CFTC Chair Brooksley Bourne. And in that capacity, he's responsible for supervising exchange-traded futures and derivatives. He also served on the steering committee of the President's Working Group on Financial Markets and is a member of the International Organization of Securities Commission's Hedge Fund Task Force, and he was later counselor to the U.S. Attorney General and the Justice Department Principal Deputy Associate Attorney General, which is a lot of words. Professor Greenberger has recently served as a technical advisor to the U.N. Commission of Experts on Reforms of the International Monetary and Financial System and the International Energy Forum's Independent Expert Group on Reducing Worldwide Energy Price Volatility. Wally Turberville will be our next speaker. He practiced law for 7 years before joining Goldman Sachs in 1985 as an investment banker. And in 12 years there, he specialized in infrastructure finance and public-private partnerships. During that time, he was posted for a great deal of time to the London office of Goldman, where he was co-head of a group tasked to pursue financing of transportation, energy, and environmental projects. And while he was in London, he served on the Consultative Committee for Public-Private Partnerships Finance of His Majesty's Treasury. I guess it's Her Majesty's Treasury. Between 1997 and 2009, he founded and led two financial firms, including one focused on the post-trade management of credit exposures in over-the-counter derivatives transactions. And since 2009, he's devoted his efforts to financial reform and is now a senior fellow at Demos. Marcus Stanley is the Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. And Dr. Stanley has a PhD in public policy from Harvard University and previously worked as an economic and policy advisor to Senator Boxer and a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee and assistant professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. And finally, Dennis Kelleher is the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, which is a nonprofit promoting the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Before that, he held several senior staff positions in the Senate, most recently as a chief counsel and senior leadership advisor to Senator Dorgan, chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Before that, he was a litigation partner with the firm of Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meagher & Flom, where he had both a national and a European practice specializing in the securities and financial markets, as well as corporate conduct and misconduct. With that, let me repeat myself once more about asking people to put their phones on mute while they're not speaking and turn the call over to Professor Greenberger.
Thank you, Lisa. Let me say at the outset, I think it's fair to say that we, AFR, Better Markets, and all the underlying groups who've supported Dodd-Frank and the proper implementation of Dodd-Frank see the question of the extraterritorial application of Dodd-Frank as the biggest remaining issue to be dealt with, and it presents a loophole in Dodd-Frank that could sink the entire regulatory structure that applies to over-the-counter derivatives or swaps. As everybody now knows, the poorly capitalized, under-collateralized, non-transparent swaps market, which at the time was roughly over $600 trillion notional value worldwide. Defaults in that market and potential defaults in that market have been viewed by most studies and experts as having led to the meltdown, having triggered the credit crisis. In response to that, the Dodd-Frank statute, which number one, in purpose, was designed to prevent future bailouts and the expenditure of excessive amounts of taxpayer money. One of its principal regulatory structures was to capitalize, collateralize, and make transparent the OTC derivative market. By and large, all standardized swaps contracts, interest rate swaps, credit derivatives, energy swaps that are subject to the jurisdiction of the CFTC must be cleared, be guaranteed by the clearing facility. The clearing facility is responsible for pricing and asking for appropriate margin in those contracts to assure that there is no counterparty risk. And Dodd-Frank sets up several mechanisms to make the swaps market a transparent market. Most importantly, those swaps dealers who do more than $8 billion in swaps business in a year have added regulatory responsibilities in that they have capital requirements that are predicate to getting involved in the swaps market, and they must comply with business conduct rules. Now, it's widely known that as part of the bailout policies, there were two international problems that the Congress addressed when it passed Dodd-Frank. Number one, and most prototypical, was the AIG scenario, where its London-based subsidiary Financial Products engaged in hundreds of billions of dollars of credit default swaps with no capital, no margin, and an inability to pay off the contractual commitments. And among other parts of the bailout was the need for the United States taxpayer to invest $180 billion to buy AIG to keep it from creating cascading systemic failures throughout the world. Number two, the Fed, through the Fed window, not only arranged substantially favorably lending practices for too-big-to-fail banks in the United States, but expended a substantial amount of money, taxpayer money, on foreign banks. Royal Bank of Scotland, $85 billion. UBS, $72 billion, Deutsche Bank, $66 billion, Barclays, $65 billion. These were amounts that were discovered by Bloomberg in its FOIA request, which was made public in April 2011. So the Dodd-Frank structure of clearing, capitalization, and transparency was designed to protect against the kind of worldwide calamity that arose in September of 2008. Congress, being fully aware of the international problem that the lack of regulation created, passed an express provision, Section 722D, of the statute, which made it clear that any swaps activity that has, quote, a direct and significant connection with activities in or effect on commerce of the United States would be covered by the Dodd-Frank requirements. There was also an anti-evasion provision that Dodd-Frank couldn't be evaded by manufacturing foreign transactions. As I'm sure everybody knows, most large financial institutions can, by the stroke of a computer key, conduct and execute swap transactions outside the sovereign United States. And in fact, in a recent article by Philip Rush of January 2012, it was stated that J.P. Morgan had 59% of its swap transactions overseas, Citigroup had 53% of its swap transaction overseas, and Bank of America had half of its swaps transaction overseas. Congress saw this and wanted transactions by U.S. bank holding companies using foreign subsidiaries to be governed by Dodd-Frank. Moreover, it's clear that Congress wanted foreign financial services industries whose subsidiaries traded in the United States to be covered by Dodd-Frank. In reaction to overwhelming opposition to the extension of 722 of Dodd-Frank on an extraterritorial basis, on July 12, 2012, the CFTC issued a proposed exemptive order. That exemptive order was mainly the result, as we see it, of lobbying by Wall Street, lobbying by House Republicans, and lobbying by foreign regulators who did not want the CFTC to have jurisdiction even over the U.S. subsidiaries of foreign banks. The regulatory structure in that proposed order, number one, gave a one-year exemption to the application of Dodd-Frank to the foreign subsidiaries, affiliates, and branches of U.S. bank holding companies, and number two, to the U.S. subsidiaries of foreign financial services corporations. That was a one-year stay of the application of Dodd-Frank, which our groups opposed because it, for 1 year, exposes the American taxpayer to the failure of U.S. banks through their foreign subsidiaries. And by the way, we now have the London Whale experience, which shows that one rogue trader of a U.S. bank holding company in London can lose somewhere between $6 and $9 billion alone. We oppose that extension. On top of the extension, there was a regulatory scheme that was proposed that, quote, U.S. persons would have to comply with Dodd-Frank even if they were the foreign subsidiaries of U.S. bank holding companies, or if those subsidiaries were guaranteed by the U.S. bank holding company, and U.S. subsidiaries of foreign financial services companies. They would be covered by Dodd-Frank unless the affected entity was located in a jurisdiction that had what the CFTC called substitutive compliance. That is a regulatory scheme that was approved by the CFTC as meeting the goals and objectives of Dodd-Frank. We thought that term, substitutive compliance, was slippery. Others will go into this, but the regulatory schemes of the United Kingdom and other countries for OTC derivatives was either non-existent or very weak, and we think the use of substitutive compliance is too vague a term. Things have gotten worse since this exemptive order was proposed. To put it simply, there are two factors that are at play that are opening up an exemption to Dodd-Frank that we think will sink it in its application to toxic swaps agreements. Number one, foreign regulators led by the European Commission do not want even U.S. subsidiaries of the foreign banks to register with the CFTC. And they are applying phenomenal pressure, aided by Wall Street, aided by Republicans, aided by foreign banks, to simply say that even if a foreign bank is a U.S. subsidiary trading in the United States, it should not be registered fully with the CFTC. That has now led the U.S. banks to make the following argument. If the their foreign competition will not be governed by Dodd-Frank, either by the home country or the U.S. subsidiaries in the United States, they are at a competitive disadvantage. And in order to eliminate that competitive disadvantage, their foreign subsidiaries, the London branch of J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, or affiliate or subsidiary, should be regulated by the United Kingdom and not the United States. That argument is gaining currency. That is evidenced by a hearing that was held on December 12th, where Chairman Gary Gensler of the CFTC testified before the House Financial Services Committee and was berated for the attempt of the CFTC to regulate foreign subsidiaries of U.S. bank holding companies or U.S. subsidiaries of foreign banks. This, obviously, already so many of these transactions, as I mentioned earlier, already conducted abroad. And what we're seeing, and an interesting article in this regard was recently written by Reuters to the effect that U.S. bank holding companies are now advising their customers to enter into their transactions with foreign subsidiaries, with their foreign subsidiaries, to avoid the impact of Dodd-Frank. The clear implication of that is it's almost encouraging outsourcing of banking to foreign countries. Don't do your business with the United States institution. Do it with one of our foreign subsidiaries. For 1 year, they're not regulated, and we are campaigning vigorously to see that they are not regulated in the long run by Dodd-Frank. Without even avoiding Dodd-Frank, the figure of the swaps that would be regulated or we thought would be regulated is well over 50% for most of these too-big-to-fail institutions. When there is an incentive to do transactions, again, through computer strokes, quote, outside the United States, close quote, this is going to be essentially a pathway to ending any U.S. regulation at all. A lot of this is being argued as a matter of comedy, that the U.S. should defer to foreign jurisdictions and be good allies. Our essential argument here is Dodd-Frank says nothing about comedy. It talks exclusively about protecting U.S. taxpayers against further bailouts. If the London Whale can lose $6 to $9 billion, one rogue trader. If AIG Financial Products was the canary in the mine for the 2008 meltdown, with all these transactions being done abroad, the risk for U.S. bank holding companies to fail because of foreign transactions, that is, of their subsidiaries in foreign countries, is phenomenally high. If U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations cause failure of foreign banks, those banks will be lining up again and making the argument, if you don't rescue us, the world economy will collapse. The U.S. taxpayer should not be put in a Hobson's choice of either having to go through another multi-trillion dollar bailout because of a ruse of extraterritoriality within Dodd-Frank, or face the next Great Depression. And we think this issue hasn't gotten enough attention. It is our intent to present the other side of this issue, the other side of Wall Street, Republicans, and foreign regulators' arguments, which focus not at all on protecting the U.S. taxpayer.
Thanks, Professor Greenberger. I'm turning the call over now to Wally Turberville.
Thanks, Lisa. It's really important to focus on the fact that the derivatives regulation, and in particular this extraterritoriality, has to be looked at to address the 21st century environment for trading derivatives. It's not, derivatives are not wedded to any physical location, as Michael was talking about. A bank doesn't care where a trader sits or where his computer connects into the World Wide Web. He could be sitting in Dublin or Dubai or in Singapore or Sydney. Those cities might want to attract the business, but in terms of where the risk resides, it doesn't make a hair's breadth of difference whether it's in Dublin or in New York or whether it's in Frankfurt, Germany or Frankfurt, Kentucky. That's why it was very wise when Dodd-Frank was drafted that they didn't talk about where corporations were organized or where the difference between subsidiaries or branches. What they talked about was the effect on the U.S. economy. That's what the defining characteristic was when looking at jurisdictions. And it's really important to distinguish some of the things that are talked about by the folks that are trying to weaken regulation. When they talk about the existing SEC jurisdiction, the SEC wasn't the SEC's main mission wasn't historically to deal with trying to keep the banking system in the United States safe. It was about fair disclosure and transparency in the marketplace. Dodd-Frank is doing something very different. It's about safety. And similarly, the EDGE Act, we shouldn't be concerned about the competition, the competitiveness of U.S. banks. This is all about the safety and soundness of the economy and protecting the American taxpayer. So the primary question here has two parts. One is, what is the scope of activity that the CFTC can cover when dealing with derivatives? How big can it be? And second, if there's an overlap between two jurisdictions over some activity, whose rules should apply? So two different questions. The history of international banking is really a great guide in terms of the first question, which is the scope. Now, historically, all the investment banks operated with subsidiaries that they guaranteed when doing transactions overseas. Banks, regular commercial banks, pre-repeal of Glass-Steagall, they operated with branches. The reason they did that was primarily because they saw that it was a benefit to them that all of their counterparts and all their different transactions got the advantage of effectively a guarantee by the federal government. But there really was no difference from a practical standpoint, whether you operated as a corporation, it was fully guaranteed, or as a branch. It was basically the same business. It was decided by other kinds of issues. So anything seems to be the case, which distinguishes between those two organizational structures, is a rule that actually doesn't make sense and would never have made sense in terms of how international banking's been done. So what we're trying to do here is cover banking activities in Europe and elsewhere where the business is done there, but the risk comes back here. And it's sort of shocking that where the guidance is may end up is that those foreign jurisdictions get the business and we get the risk. Same thing happens. Same principle applies when a foreign institution deals with a U.S. affiliate or branch. That's another transmission vehicle for getting the risk back here. You got to remember that institutions like Goldman Sachs, some of their largest counterparts are institutions like Deutsche Bank or the Royal Bank of Scotland. So if you're talking about an institution doing fundamentally U.S. derivatives business through a foreign branch or affiliate, it's the same as if they were doing it here in terms of the basic issue, which is risk to the economy. got to the position where there was really broad jurisdiction, what about when rules overlap? And we're really talking there about substituted compliance. You know, comity is an important concept, and duplicative regulation is as well. But the CFTC has to make certain that if it defers to another jurisdiction, the foreign rules are just as good as the U.S. version. This means how they're written, but it also means how they're enforced. And recent events tell us why that's critically important. It's widely assumed that the European Union, for instance, is likely to have rules that are parallel to the U.S. regime. However, those rules don't exist yet. We can't read them, and we have no idea how they're going to be enforced. So the question comes, why should we be concerned? Shouldn't we trust that the rules will be the same? Don't the Europeans have the same incentive as ours? The answer to that is an emphatic no. There's no accident coincidence that AIG credit default swaps are written in London. And London Wales operations were in London, obviously. I was there for 5 years. I recognize there's a different attitude that really exists in the environment in the UK and the rest of Europe and in the United States. Right now, it's very important to note that the European Union is going through some real difficult times. We're all aware of that. The United Kingdom, the public opinion polls and political rhetoric would lead us in the direction of thinking that a new referendum is going to be coming up in the next few years that could lead to a departure of the UK from the European Union. I mean, all you have to do is look at the front cover of The Economist from last week, and you'll see that that's the case. So politically, what's happening as the Europeans try to get to some form of regulation is that the UK has become very, very influential. Now, why that's important is that in the United Kingdom, the financial sector is very important to the whole economy. The financial sector in the UK is twice as big in proportion as it is in Germany or France or the other areas of the European Union. So what's happening is that in order to draw the UK closer, more and more they are in control of what's going on with financial regulation, and they have a very strong incentive to protect the banking industry. So we don't know what's going to happen and whether the regulations as they're actually written or enforced will be appropriate for substituted compliance. We do know this, for instance, that we do know that back in the summer when Standard Chartered was being looked at for money laundering, up until the very day before Standard Chartered agreed to a $450 million payment to avoid prosecution, UK regulators were saying that the whole money laundering thing was a fabrication designed to favor U.S. banks by weakening a British institution. So we do know that there's this great incentive on the UK side to protect their banks, and we do know that the UK is in a particularly strong position to deal with, to influence the way regulations come out in Europe. So the point is here that once the scope of jurisdiction is established and it's broad, which it isn't yet, but if it's done correctly, any substituted compliance has to be carefully reviewed over time. And this review has to be ongoing with attention paid to actual enforcement. This has to be done correctly because otherwise the business will move offshore, and it will be done. It'll be moved offshore in order to avoid the regulation. It'll be, as has been said, it'll be a hole in the regulation the size of the one that sank the Titanic. It would have very similar consequences. So it's quite important that we get this one right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Wally. Marcus?
Thank you. Well, just a few things to expand on what was previously said, which I thought was a great coverage, that, global regulators, financial regulators, understood very well that this is a global market, that you have to regulate it globally. And to that end, we do have G20 agreements where all the major countries that do significant and financial business have agreed to regulate their derivatives markets along similar lines to what's in Dodd-Frank, but they lag well behind the United States in terms of actually putting that into practice. And what we're seeing is that both the big banks and foreign regulators are using this lag period to, I think with the big banks in particular, using this lag period to attempt to weaken and undermine regulations in ways that could be permanent. And the first is simply by saying that the U.S. can't enforce anything until other countries have completed their rules, because this will supposedly create a competitive disadvantage. And, we have continually seen assurances that Europe is close to finishing its rules, but when you look at the actual things that European regulators are saying, a high-level European regulator recently told a conference publicly in London that they would not complete their basic clearing requirements until the middle of 2014. The CFTC is ready to complete them now. The middle of 2014 would be a year past the end of this exemption period, the current exemption period the CFTC is proposing. So what we're seeing is pressure to turn these exemption periods into an open-ended exemption that would essentially say that no one can regulate until everyone has regulated, that we slow down the pace of global regulation to whoever the slowest country in the world is. And this would be a huge problem, obviously. And the second argument that they're using is they're using this period where the U.S. has rules ready to go and other countries don't to make this competitive disadvantage argument that, if U.S. banks are governed by these rules and other banks aren't, then we'll lose business in our foreign subsidiaries to the foreign subsidiaries of other banks or to banks that are incorporated in different countries. And that's first of all strange because we're talking about the foreign subsidiaries here, so this is implicitly an argument for the offshoring of U.S. jobs. And it's also strange because if it's really true that there's a quote-unquote competitive disadvantage, what that's saying is that other countries have laxer regulation of their derivatives markets. And the whole point here is that, if we believe that there was a competitive disadvantage created by strong regulation of the derivatives market, and we believe that strong regulation of the derivatives market didn't bring enormous economic benefits in terms of financial stability and taxpayer protection, then we wouldn't have passed the Dodd-Frank Act in the first place. The whole point here is to get strong derivatives regulations. So the danger is that we're going to see this indefinite delay, and we're going to see these exemptions put in place in the name of competitive equality, exempting foreign subsidiaries of U.S. banks because they may compete with foreign banks, exempting branches of U.S. banks when they compete with foreign subsidiaries of U.S. banks. This series of exemptions will start to unravel the whole structure of Dodd-Frank derivatives oversight. And during this potentially unlimited delay period or open-ended delay period, these exemptions will get cemented in place and eventually be made permanent. So those are big dangers. And if we can just get through this transitional period, where other countries are putting their derivatives regulations in place and have the courage to lead the way during that period, to step out and say, all right, the U.S. is first. The U.S. is the first country that has these rules. We're going to put these rules in place. U.S. banks are going to follow these rules. Then we're going to create pressure for other countries to come up to our level, and we're also going to create a competitive advantage for U.S. banks because U.S. banks will be the banks that have the most practice in this new derivatives regime. U.S. banks will be the safest and best regulated global banks, and anybody who knows the financial markets can tell you right now that it is a competitive advantage to be perceived as backed by a very strong regulatory regime, a very stable country. That attracts business. So if we can stick to our political courage that we had in passing the Dodd-Frank Act, and step forward and lead the way globally through this transitional period to the other side, which is strong global derivatives regulation, then that's going to create greater protections for U.S. taxpayers. It's going to create create advantages for the U.S. economy, and it's going to create a stronger global derivatives regime in the long run.
Thanks, Marcus. Dennis, in the cleanup spot?
Hi, everybody. I know that after more than a half hour, there's nothing more people want to do than hear from me. I just want to make two very quick points and then get your questions and discuss the things that are on your mind. But I want to reiterate what people have said, which is that the financial reform law was passed to protect the American people from another financial crisis. And you can look at that a number of different ways, but according to a Better Market study, the last crisis is going to cost the U.S. more than $12.8 trillion. And as we know, the economic wreckage from that is still being suffered by the American people from coast to coast. So that is what is at stake when we talk about financial reform and getting financial reform right and getting the rules right, including, very importantly, what's called the cross-border rule that we're talking about. It's also important to remember that the U.S. government and U.S. taxpayers stopped the last crisis and bailed out the global financial system. It wasn't London or Brussels or Berlin. It was the United States. And that isn't to say no one else did anything, but the United States carried the load, and without the U.S. doing that, the system would have collapsed. And it's almost certainly likely to happen the same way next time. So when people try and limit the reach of U.S. financial reform rules that are intended to protect the global financial system, the U.S. government and taxpayers from another financial and economic crisis, the real question is what should outweigh that? And when you strip away the pretext and the rhetoric, what the industry and its allies are arguing for is outsourcing and offshoring the protection of the American people from another financial collapse. And that really is what at stake. And I think Michael Wally and Marcus went through many of the aspects of that. But those are the first principles in the big picture that shouldn't get lost here. And I think with that, I'll conclude. Let's hear what you have to say and want to talk about.
Thanks to you all. So if folks will say their name and what outlet they're with before they ask their question, that would be great. I know that we may be losing Wally more quickly than other speakers, so just to alert everyone to that. Are there questions or comments?
Hi, this is Zach Warnprott with Politico. In addition to this call, what else are you trying to do to get this point across to the CFTC, and is there still time to do that?
Well, this is Dennis. Speaking for Better Markets, anyway, and I think this is shared by the group, we've all filed comment letters, and Better Markets has been in on two rounds of meetings with the commissioners and their staff, and another round is coming up. I don't believe it's too late to have these discussions. I think that there are still a number of issues under active consideration. And I think that in addition to groups going, filing comment letters or going in for meetings, the public discussion, and very importantly, and Zach, you've been out front on this with some of your colleagues, but the public reporting on what's at stake here and how it's going to play out is really important. And it's so I think there's a number of issues that are still open, and they're still subject to being changed or finalized for the better.
Yeah, this is Marcus from AFR, and AFR has also been meeting with CFTC commissioners and with congressional staff. But to reinforce what Dennis said, this is definitely not over. There's been a lot of progress that industry has made in terms of getting exemptions through June 2013. And that is something that in some cases may be difficult to reverse. But what they're really after is not just that exemption through June 2013. They want to use the next 6 months to, first of all, make that June 2013 exemption open-ended in time. And second of all, to get in place various exemptions for particular institutions, whether that's their foreign guaranteed subsidiaries or their branches or even some U.S. subsidiaries. They want to get in place those exemptions and then make them permanent beyond that June 2013 date. And in their effort to do that, they're greatly help by the fact that this has been sort of a backroom argument, you know, about what seem to be boring technical details of derivatives implementation. And it's critical to get this out and have folks like you and the journalists who are following this and the public understand this is not just a technical thing. This is really about an effort to kind of snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here in terms of derivatives regulation, and it's potentially a last-ditch effort to undermine everything we achieved in the Dodd-Frank Act in terms of derivatives regulation. And I think once that's understood, the debate will change.
This is Jamila Trimble with Dow Jones of the Wall Street Journal. I was just, Gensler said at that hearing that somebody referenced on the 12th that not covering foreign affiliates of U.S. banks would blow a hole through Title VII. So he clearly agrees with you guys to a certain point. I mean, do you see him as, this is a sort of, he would like to see this as like sort of a transitioning period the next 6 months for foreign affiliates. I mean, do you think he just doesn't have the support on the commission to do more than that, or is this too, is he making a concession here that's just too big, or how do you guys see his role in this? Because he seems to agree with you.
Well, we obviously are relying on a lot of things Gary has said. But in terms of the question, is it too late, there needs to be, the proposed exemptive order needs to be finalized. As we understand it, that's still under discussion, a long way away, and all of us will be, as we've said, be working with the commissioners and the commission staff to make our point clear, especially our point that seems to be getting lost, is that nobody's paying attention to the American taxpayer being the party holding the bag if foreign subsidiaries of U.S. banks fail or U.S. subsidiaries of foreign banks fail. Also, yeah, this is just getting warmed up in Congress. Obviously, the House Republicans have their point of view on it, but we are going to engage in a campaign with our allies on the Hill who are supportive of Dodd-Frank, to have them be as vocal as we're trying to be about protecting the American taxpayer and not creating a loophole that swallows the entire statute.
Sorry, Molly?
No, it was Dennis. I was going to say, Jamila, it's Dennis of Better Markets. You're exactly right that the chairman has been strong on this issue, and consistent with his testimony and other public statements, he sees the 6 months as a transition period, as do we. The real issue is kind of the details of the other provisions and holding fast on the 6 months. And if he's, you could say if he's already there, why are we saying this? And if they've already got this done, why do we sound concerned? And I think given the unrelenting onslaught by Wall Street to try and get the scope of the application of the rules that protect the American taxpayers cut back as far as possible, AFR and, you know, Michael at the University of Maryland and Wally at Demos and others, including many others, are making sure that we're trying to keep up the pressure and highlight the key issues that support the strongest rule possible. So it's not in conflict. It's complementary to what the chairman is doing, and it's being supportive of getting the strongest possible guidance done and finalized as soon as possible.
So you guys aren't against the six-month extension. You're just against the possibility of the six-month extension turning into a longer exemption.
Well, speaking for Better Markets, we're not against a six-month period that is really a six-month period, provided that the other provisions, definition of U.S. persons, et cetera, are sufficiently strong. But the 6 months is fine.
We have expressed a lot more doubt and opposition from AFR about the six-month exemption, but I think we definitely agree with Better Markets that if it's genuinely a six-month exemption and the underlying regulations are strong, which in some cases they have not been even in the proposal, and it's genuinely kept to 6 months, then you know then that would
we disagree at all. That's why I said, you know, 6 months is 6 months. We don't have a problem with that. If 6 months is 9 months, 12 months, et cetera, then we have a big problem with that. So I think we're on the same page.
And let me, this is Michael, let me add that what we are hearing is that these groups want to extend the six-month period and or have substitutive compliance mean whatever is in place or likely to be in place. So therefore, even if the 6 months ends, they are lobbying for being deemed in substitutive compliance if they can get their regulations in effect by 2015, or in this case of the UK, they're talking about 2019. So what substitutive compliance means when the 6 months end is going to be very, very important.
Yeah, Michael, and there may be a question on this, but Michael hits a key point, which is the content of substituted compliance. We've taken a very hard line that substituted compliance has to be inform, substance, enforcement, and over time. And we know from history, and including recent history, that enforcement or purported enforcement overseas has been abysmally bad. And if you just look at London, it's not just AIGFP or the London Whale. Look at the LIBOR example, where the FSA, the Bank of England, and every other regulator in London actually knew concretely about the manipulation for years and did nothing. You can look at the recent rogue trader for UBS that lost, I think it was $2 or $4 or $8 billion. I can't remember. That happened in London. Northern Rock was nationalized, and the FSA report on that showed that there wasn't a single supervisory review of that gigantic bank for more than 3 years. When Barclays was nationalized, it was leveraged 61-1. And then, of course, there's RBS and the entire long history of failure. So, you know, it's not like we're concerned about the industry using substituted compliance as a way to avoid all compliance. That's not a frivolous concern. History is littered recently and in the last 10 years with example after example of foreign regulators falling down on the job to the tune of, you know, egregious blindness.
And the insult to injury is that when all goes south, the U.S. taxpayer is looked to fix it up. And the U.S. and the needs or the goals to protect the U.S. taxpayer have to date been lost in the entire discussion.
Are there more questions? All right, going once. Well, thank you very much all to the speakers on the call and to everybody who listens and asks questions. We really appreciate your taking the time to engage on this. If folks on the call, if reporters on the call would send Patrick@OurFinancialSecurity.org a note letting us know you were on so we can be sure to send you the follow-up materials, that would be excellent. Again, it's Patrick@OurFinancialSecurity.org, and that way we can make sure to send you follow-up materials. A copy of the recording of the call will be available shortly. Thanks very much, all.